So I'm Tom Kirkman. I hope that you have already picked up one of those three handouts there. Do our countdown. Okay, so this is kind of how the class is usually going to be set up. I call those things handouts, but you can see I don't actually hand them out. And particularly for the first mod of classes, there'll typically be a bunch of stuff to pick up. I'll typically write the assignments for the that are due the following day on that part of the board, and I'll typically write on this part of the board a review of what we did the previous class. And if you don't take any notes in this class, the kind of the least you should do is copy down the review board, because that's kind of the only review you're going to get for an exam in order to help you, incidentally not today, because we didn't review previous class. So if we look at your three handouts, you've got some homework, and like homework always, you're going to be turning this in on Friday. The plan is to make a scale model and put it on this chart so that it's going to look in the end kind of like that. So obviously our topic for the day is going to be how we make these sorts of scale models. You should have this handout, which has to do with the night labs. So Friday, posted on the board, there'll be this sign-up sheet, and anytime before class, you can sign up for a particular slot for the three night labs that you're going to be doing. And you should also have a syllabus. So I won't bother to read you the syllabus, but maybe I'll pick out three key things that you might notice. First of all, the exam dates are there, right? So if you want to schedule your life now, you can put those exam times in now. And incidentally, if you look at the class website, which is www.physics.csbsgu/astro, notice that the old exams are online. So you'll have a good way of studying for your exam by looking at these old exams that are online. If you look at this warning section, so in addition to the three labs at the observatory, you're going to be doing two labs on your own. We call these things home labs. So Friday I'll be handing out this home lab manual. And it turns out that this is something that students not uncommonly fail at. And I think the reasons are pretty clear. It requires you to schedule observations throughout the semester, kind of one a week. And no matter how careful you are, that schedule is going to break. So it's not so much a matter of making and following a schedule, it's a matter of learning what happens when it's cloudy, when you've scheduled yourself to observe. So you got to make a schedule, and you have to make a plan for what you're going to do when, and for sure will, when your schedule doesn't in fact work out. So we'll take a look at this next time, but be forewarned that it's almost always a problem for students. You got to make a plan and then more or less stick to it. So maybe the other important thing here is this thing about questions. So you may notice that the syllabus doesn't have a list of topics that we're going to cover on any particular day. So you really can ask most any question you want, and in this class or in my office, and you know, try and get your questions answered, as opposed to doing whatever I've thought that we're going to do on a particular day. Okay, so my office is down two floors and a little bit that way. And there's an office hour that's listed on that syllabus, but you shouldn't feel at all constrained by that. I'm there most of the time with the following problem, and that is that science teachers are almost always spending a lot of time in labs. So days 2 through 5, I'm in the lab basically all afternoon. So if you see me in lab, it's not uncommon that I can answer like a 5-minute question. But I probably can't answer a half an hour question when I'm in lab. And you can also do questions by email, but you know that doesn't work super well unless it's a short answer, you know, like, you know, can I postpone this exam or something like that. Okay? So the textbooks, this is the textbook that's in the bookstore. We'll use it extensively. We've got our home lab, and probably the, I won't say the most important thing, but certainly equal to all of those things is this website. If you look, you'll see lots of things called tutorials and quizzes. We'll be doing, particularly for the first mod, lots of quizzes and information that's based on this online website. So if I were you, I would bookmark this website so you can find it pretty easily. Notice in particular, as part of your homework, you're supposed to do this pretest. That's right there. And it looks, you know, like any multiple choice test. So, you know, kind of why bother? Well, we really would like to prove that you've learned something in this class, and there isn't a good way of measuring student learning. So I won't claim that this is a particularly good way to show what you've learned, but we've kind of put together some questions that are things you might have picked up along the way and that you probably will hear something about in this course. So we hope to see that you do poor on this to begin with and good on this in the end. So for this first part of the pretest, I don't care what you pick randomly for all I care, although I guess I hope you don't do that. So you'll only be graded on whether you did it or not. When you take the same test at the end of the course, I really will grade you on you know, whether you did a good job or a bad job on it. Okay, so these sort of assessment tests are becoming pretty common. Questions about anything? Well, you may notice that I'm recording this lecture when I remember, which is most of the time. There'll be an online link to the lecture. So if you miss a day, you have a pretty good way of catching up on what actually went on in class. But of course, I can't record what's on the board, so it's less than perfect. But it's, I think, better than nothing. Okay, so our main agenda for today is to talk about scale models. But before we get down to that, I want to distinguish three words that people sometimes find confusing and misuse. And those are universe, solar system, and galaxy. So the universe is the whole shebang. It's everything that we could ever know about. And people sometimes speculate that they're multi-universes, but it's kind of irrelevant if there are. We can't learn anything about them. They're totally disconnected from our universe. There's no way that light would travel from one of those universes to our universe. There's no way that we could travel from those universes. So for all intents and purposes, the universe is everything we could ever learn about. And what we have learned over the years is that the universe is made up out of galaxies. So this is an image of a random piece of sky. That is to say, this wasn't selected to be anything special. And what you see here, every dot in this image, even the ones that maybe look like stars, except this one, and maybe there's, I think there are two, this one, everything else in here is a galaxy. And every galaxy is a collection of way more than a billion stars. So our galaxy, for example, has more than 100 billion stars in it. So galaxies often have particular shapes. This is kind of a spiral galaxy. There's another spiral galaxy. That's what our galaxy is. Other galaxies are kind of like elongated eggs. And we'll learn more about these. But the universe is made up out of presumably an infinite number of collections of stars that are called galaxies. Okay, and we can see other galaxies. You can even see them with your naked eye with a little bit of work. The solar system is the local stuff. Right? I used to say the nine planets and the sun, right? But they deleted Pluto. But basically the things that NASA is involved with, the things that we could, you know, actually go visit if we worked hard to do. These other things are way too far away in order for us to visit. So galaxies are made up out of zillions of stars. Presumably lots of those stars have planets going around them in our little solar systems. We know about, on the order of 500 solar systems around stars. They're pretty hard to detect. Our best guess is that probably most stars have solar systems. In any case, there are zillions of stars in a galaxy, and there are zillions of galaxies in the universe. Okay, so kind of don't misuse those three terms. Pretty commonly done in science fiction movies. Okay, so the main topic for today is scale models. And you can see that that's what the homework is. And the plan is to have this object be the sun and to try and figure out which one of these balls should represent the Earth and where we should put it. And I put some data on the board. And incidentally, the data is something, so these sorts of numbers are something that you'll never have to learn in this course. And so I will never ask you what the diameter of the sun is. All right, so we don't really care a whole lot about numbers in this class. If there is a number, usually I'll tell you what the important number is. So I've written down here from a book what the radius of the sun is, what the radius of the Earth is, what the radius of the largest planet is, which is Jupiter, and what the Earth-Sun distance is, which is called an astronomical unit, or an AU. And in doing that, I don't know, we already maybe have some questions, like what is this? So in this class, basically everything is going to be in what people often call the metric system. More technically, it's the System International, the SI system. And the basis of the system of units is a meter. Right? So this is a meter stick, looks a lot like a yardstick, close enough to a yard for our purposes. And that's the primary unit of distance in this system. And I've used kind of that system here, but very commonly we won't be using it in this class just because the stars are hugely distant away. So for us, not today, but in the future, it'll be helpful to have a larger unit to deal with. And the most common unit that people understand is a light year. I say that, although it's not uncommonly misused also. So a light year is the distance light would travel in a year. So it takes the sun's light 7 or 8 minutes to reach the Earth. So we're 7 or 8 light minutes from the sun. Nearby stars are on the order of 4 light years away. The size of our galaxy, one of these little spirals, is about 100,000 light years. The distance to the nearest big galaxy is about 2.5 million light years. So none of those numbers should you bother to record. Just try to give you a feeling for size. So professionally, astronomers use parsecs. And I will try and avoid this term. It's about three light years. So roughly speaking, the nearest star is about 1 parsec away. And I don't know, in a month maybe we'll define what a parsec is, but I'm happiest using what I think is a more reasonable unit, one that's more tied to your experience. You know that light moves pretty fast, and you know that year is a pretty long time. So a light year has to be a pretty big distance. So the M stands for meter, the K stands for kilo, which means that we're multiplying it by 1,000. So if we take about 1,000 of these meters, we're going to get a pretty long distance. It's short of a mile, roughly speaking about 1.5 kilometers, well really 1.6 kilometers is about a mile. And there are a bunch of these multipliers that are used to make bigger units to measure things. And I'm going to want you to memorize these multipliers. So if we start at the big end, we have a capital G, which is for giga, and that means a billion. Incidentally, one of the problems with the word billion is it turns out it means something different in this country than it means in England. In this country, it means 1,000 million. In England, it means 1 million million. And then we've got a mega, right, 6 zeros for 1 million. Then we've got a kilo. We've already talked about that. That's 1,000. And of course, then we've got, we don't need a multiplier, right? 1, 5 meters. And then we need things that are going the other way that are smaller. So we have a milli. And that's 1/1000th. So a millimeter is 1/1000th of a meter, and it's about the different distance between my two fingertips now, right? So it's a pretty small unit. So we got millo, we've got micro. This is the Greek letter mu. And that's 1/1000th. And finally, we got nano. And that's a billionth. And you might guess that there are bigger and smaller units that that have been defined, but I hope we won't need them in this course. So you should be familiar with all of these guys. They won't play a huge role on our test, but they probably will play a little bit of a role.
So nano is a billionth?
Nano, thank you. Yes, nano is a billionth, and it is miswritten on the board. More corrections, comments, questions? Well, the next thing we've got going for us is this piece here. And I don't know, you saw that I kind of got, well, I made a mistake there, right, counting the number of zeros. It would be nice if we had a more compact way of describing these things without putting in all of these zeros. And the same way that your calculator does, it usually is called scientific notation. So we pick out the power of 10 and we separate it out from the basic number. So this thing here would be 10 to the sixth. And this thing here would be 0.001. This would be 10 to the minus 3. This would be 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 9th, 10 to the 9th, etc. So the System International picks out these powers of 3 to give special names to. But there's no reason that we have to. So for example, I could write this as 7.14 times 10 to the 5th, times 10 to the 4th kilometers. And notice kind of this crazy idea, which I don't know exactly what the history of it. So here I have 10 to the 3 and here I have 10 to the 4. You know, why not just combine those as 10 to the 7th? I don't know. People don't do it. People like kilometers as kind of a normal distance unit. Typically, these sorts of things would be entered in your calculator with, I don't know, a button that might be labeled EE, enter exponent. You're not going to have much use for your calculators in this class, but it's imaginable that you might have to enter those numbers. And of course, you can always enter them with lots of zeros if you want. And you're kind of invited to do that with this problem for homework. You notice I didn't write things in scientific notation for those numbers. Okay. Okay, so with that explanation of the data, how can we actually go and make a scale model? Well, let's maybe take a look at some common examples of scale models first, right? So this is a scale model of a cell, right? You undoubtedly saw that in your high school biology course. And the idea is that things are in proportion in this size. So this thing here, which is probably a mitochondria, you can see it's, I don't know, maybe a sixth or so of the diameter of the cell. You can put things in proportion. So here we have a lineup of the planets. And again, the idea is we can see, roughly speaking, how big these things are and how they are compared to each other. So here's kind of the giant planets in a similar sort of comparison. So we do this not only with space, but we also do it with time. And so here's, for example, a scale model of time going backwards in time with the normal geological features. Okay, so if we kind of go over these ideas of galaxies and stars. So this thing here, third time's the charm, this thing here is kind of a scale model of our galaxy. Right? The sun is not in a special spot. It's roughly speaking two-thirds of the way out of this disk that is our galaxy. And if we look at this disk face on, it looks like those spirals that we were looking at before. So it is really kind of frisbee-shaped. So here's kind of a scale model of the inner parts of our solar system. Here's kind of the picture of the sun itself with the neighboring stars that you can see are several light years out. Okay, so that's the sort of thing we're trying to make. a scale model of the solar system, except we're trying to do it in three dimensions. Why not, since we've got three dimensions? And the plan is that this guy is the sun. And we need to put things in proportion if we're going to make a scale model. So, key word here is proportion, which means the same thing as ratio. And we need to have things be in the same proportion in our model as they are in the real world. Right? So if the mitochondria is, in real life, 1/6 of the size of our cell, in the little picture we make of it, the mitochondria should be 1/6 the size of the cell. Same ratio. So if we're going to set up ratios, I've got the real data here. Right, that's the 6.96 times 10 to the fifth kilometers. I need to know what the model value of the sun is. Right, so I need to measure what the radius is of this guy. And I don't know, so kind of take these guys. You can get the diameter. So it's important to recognize this is a diameter, not a radius. And you can see it's about 14 centimeters, or 140 millimeters if you insist. So that's a diameter, the other thing was a radius. So let's start with the Earth. The actual radius of the Earth according to this is, now the Earth isn't a perfectly smooth surface, so that's kind of a rounded number. The distance from the center to the pole is different from the center to Ecuador, but good enough for our purposes. And what we're trying to find is how big the model is. And I'll ask for the model diameter because those things are more easily measured. And I have to set things in proportion. So the model diameter of the sun is to the actual radius of the sun as the model diameter of the Earth. So often we use x for the unknown. Divided by the actual radius of the sun. Put things in proportion. The way I've set it up was to do sun to Earth on either side of the equation. Incidentally, I could have set it up just as well by putting things kilometers on one side and model sizes on the other. Right? So I'll get the same answer if I take Earth divided by sun in the real world versus Earth divided by sun in the model world, right? Either way works. Okay, so this is the way we started, so let's go this way. So typically what we do in order to solve these sort of equations, and you learn this in high school, I'm not sure what your favorite way of saying it is, numbers in the denominator on the right-hand side come up to be in the numerator on the left-hand side. Or maybe a mathematician would say multiply both sides by 6,400 and you get a cancellation on the right-hand side. Either way, I got this number times the 14 centimeters divided by the 6.96 times 10 to the fifth kilometers. That's supposed to be what x is. Okay, well, we're soon going to crank this number out on our calculator, but boy, I'm sure you were told this 1,000 times in grade school, but it really does pay to think before you punch numbers in your calculator to estimate, to kind of guesstimate, you don't have to be particularly accurate, what the answer is. And then when you punch your keys of your calculator, you get something radically different. You got something to think about, right? Otherwise, if you punched them into your calculator, all you can do is punch them in again, and you'll probably get the same answer. So it really helps to kind of estimate what the answer would be before you tackle the real problem. And the estimate doesn't have to be particularly accurate. So if we're not going to be particularly accurate, now I can close my eyes and call that number 7. And this number isn't particularly close to 7, but let's call it 7 just to see how it works out. Because then I'll have a 7 in the numerator and the denominator, and they'll cancel. So this is going to be 7,000 kilometers. And here I have 7 and 5 zeros. We won't do anything with the centimeters yet. And now we've got big cancellation, right? The 7 goes away. 1, 2, 3 of these guys go away. So what we've got is 1/100th of 14 centimeters. Now I can calculate that just fine in my head, right? That's going to be 0.14 centimeters, or about a millimeter. And millimeter is a tenth of a centimeter. Centimeter stands for 1/100th of a meter. And it doesn't fit into the system, but I think the history is that they wanted something that was kind of like an inch. So they invented this unit, which is handy. It's marked on here. Otherwise, you get large numbers of millimeters. Okay, so that's what I'm expecting. Let's crank it out on the calculator and get the right answer. So we've got, I want to say another word, but since I said I'm going to crank it, I'm going to crank it. So I've got 6,400, and I've got 6.96 inner exponent 5 dividing, and then I've got 14 times. And what I get here, quote unquote exactly, is 0.1287. So what's the unit? Millimeters, kilometers, light years? Well, the unit should work out too. And notice that I've got a kilometers in the numerator and I've got a kilometer in the denominator, so those two guys will go away. So the only unit that's left on the left-hand side is centimeters, so that has to be the unit of interest, right? So close enough to 0.13 centimeters for our answer. Okay, so I got lots of balls here. Which one is going to work for the Earth? So here's something to measure small things with. So I can set this to, it's actually in millimeters, so I'll set it to 1.3. So I'm looking for a ball that's about that size, right? So not baseballs, not golf balls, not these guys, not this guy. I don't know if you can see it. I'm sure you can't see it, but there's a magnet here. There's a little ball there, and it's too big. It doesn't fit in the calipers. Okay, so Earth is pretty small compared to the sun, kind of immeasurably small compared to the sun. Features like sunspots on the surface of the sun are bigger than the Earth is. Okay, so that's kind of a start to our scale model. Where do we put the Earth? Right, so we got this little tiny dot. Where does it go in space? Right, so it's more of the same, set things into proportion. So now we have the actual, radius of the Earth orbit. That's equal to 150 million kilometers. And what we want is the model distance, Earth-Sun distance. Right, which is a radius. And all we have to do is set things in proportion.
We're measuring diameters, right? And then, but when you're computing it, you're using radius.
Care is required. So What is true is that the ratio of diameter to radius is 2, and so it cancels out on both of those sides. So as long as we have equivalent things, we're safe. But we want to be really careful when we don't have equivalent things. So for example, here I've got radius, radius, radius. I better have radius. So when I plug this number into my calculator in the end, I better set in half of it. If I did it literally exactly like I did here, you know, just put in the 150 million, now these two things are not in proportion, and I'm in trouble. Okay? It might be clearer in this form here that if I multiply and divide both of these things by 2, it doesn't change what the ratio is. More questions? So that, practically speaking, we have this kind of problem in that radii are the things that people usually report, but diameters for physical objects, for objects you can pick up in your hand, it's almost always easier to measure diameter. And it's easy to forget that you've made that substitution. Okay, so where do we put our little tiny dot that is the Earth? We have to set things in proportion. And so what we've got is the actual radius of the sun, right? The 6.96 times 10 to the fifth kilometers. And what the radius is in our model, namely just 7 centimeters, that needs to be in proportion to the actual distance between the Earth's sun and the unknown distance that we're going to have in our model. So once again, what you learned in high school is that that thing can come up in the numerator on the other side. So once again, we can crank this out on our calculators, but I don't know if you believe me, but I bet every teacher you've had since grade school has told you that it's really smart to estimate your answers, not just crank them out on your calculator. So let's try and estimate what our answer is going to be. So if we play the same game, this number is very close to 7, and this number actually is 7, so we've got an easy cancellation there. So we're going to have 150 times 10 to the 6th, and the 7s have gone away, so this is 1 times 10 to the 5th. So we got 6 zeros here and 5 zeros there, so we get a huge cancellation, and we just have 1 zero. And we can check the units now as opposed to in the future, right? The kilometers went away. So the only unit that's left on that side is centimeters. So that's 1,500 centimeters. Now a centimeter is 1/100 of a meter. So this is going to be 15 meters. Okay, so that's our estimate. What's the actual answer? So we've got 7, 6.96 inter exponent 5 divide and 150 inter exponent 6 times. Well, basically the same. This was a pretty close estimate. 1508.6 centimeters. So close enough to 15 meters. So let's see how that works, right? So remember, this is too big for the Earth, and people in the front row can maybe see it, but It's on a magnet, so I don't have to worry about dropping it. So this is the Earth, got the whole world in my hands, and I need to put it 15 meters away. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Okay, so, I don't know. It's one way to get your instructor out of the room, I guess. So the lesson is that it's mostly empty space, right? There's not much actually there. So in pictures that we try and draw, models of the solar system, there's one thing that is always fools you, and you think that Jupiter is maybe even bigger than this line. But it's not. It's way tiny compared to the size of the sun. So there's huge, vast distances between objects in the solar system. So I don't know if you watch movies, you see pictures of spacecraft going through the asteroid belt, and you know it's dangerous. They have to bob and weave in order to do that. But as a matter of fact, the asteroids are widely separated compared to their radius. You can shoot a bullet right through the asteroid belt, and it's highly unlikely for it to hit anything. There's basically nothing out there. Mostly empty space in the solar system. And the solar system is way got more stuff in it than the galaxy as a whole. And you see from the picture that there are big distances between the galaxies. And so, you've signed up for a course that covers basically nothing, right? There's nothing out there, even though there's everything out there. And in the end, we'll make the statement that the universe actually consists of mostly stuff that we don't even experience. So everything that you know and love is a very small fraction of the universe that you're seeing. So nearly nothing is the story. So there are a couple of more words I want to get into our vocabulary. These have kind of related but different meanings. So an extensive property is a property where more is more. Right, so if there's more national debt, there's more national debt. Right, so in a scale model, more is going to be more. Pluto in our scale model is going to be further out than the Earth is, right? I forget, kilometers away from this version of the sun. Intensive things are things where more isn't more. I know, that sounds crazy. So what are some examples? Temperature. More is more there.
Well, more isn't more.
Oh, you want more. Right, so if you have a glass of water from Lake Superior, it has the same temperature as Lake Superior, right? It doesn't matter whether you've got more or not. It's still the same amount. And intensive things where more isn't more are actually pretty useful because they tend to be things that are more characteristic of the material. Right, so, I don't know, knowing that Lake Superior has, you know, a zillion kilograms of water doesn't help me as much as knowing the temperature, what the temperature of that water is. So often we're interested in intensive quantities. Another example of intensive quantity is density. And density is actually a telling intensive property because it shows how you often construct them. So what density is, it's the ratio of two extensive properties. So if we take the mass and we divide it by the volume, more is more in the numerator and more is more in the denominator, and that more is just going to cancel out. So if we have the density of gold, it's the same whether we have a little piece of gold or a big piece of gold. It's an intensive property. And it's good because now we can test whether it's gold, right? We can see whether the density that's in the book, you can't really put extensive properties in books unless you have big tables. You can see whether that intensive property matches what you actually go and measure. Right? You can have your eureka moment. Now there's a similar idea in invariant. So what I mean by invariant here is a quantity that is literally the same in the scale model as it is in the real world. And obviously, the real model of the solar system more or less fit in this room, whereas the real solar system is big. So that's certainly not an invariant property. Can you think of any invariant properties of the scale model?
Could color be one?
So I like color a lot. But I'm kind of, I would probably have to grade it right on a test, but I don't want to grade it right now. I'd say that more in terms of an intensive quantity. One thing that's going to be bothersome in this class is people often make false color scale models. So they color things differently to kind of bring out details. So often scale model, the color that's involved is not the color of the real object, particularly in this course. But also, for example, in a microbiology course, you know, where the bacteria might be colored red or something, but they're not red in real life. So yes and no, and next. Invariant quantity, something that would be the same, literally the same, in the map as in the real world. I'm not sure what location means.
Right.
See, the map could be any place, right? So I can have a Google map of Seattle in this room. So the location of the map and the location of Seattle are different.
Well, if the scale of the diagram of the map is actual size. Then...
Yeah, so if you're saying that the map is actually actual size, then they're the same. But... Well, it would be different, right? So, I mean, we saw a map of the solar system that barely fit in this room, and we saw one that fit on the overhead projector.
Proportion?
Well,
where are the ratios?
Ratios would be good, right? So anything that's a ratio would be invariant in our map. But I think that begs the question, what commonly measured quantity is a ratio? Right? Usually we think of ratios as things you have to pull out your calculator for. And they might be invariant, but maybe not helpfully so. So imagine you're orienteering for the ROTC, and you're told that you're going to go 5 miles north, and then you're going to turn 35 degrees and go 6 miles, and then you're going to turn 45 degrees. Yeah, if you think about it, the angle is exactly the same in a map as it is in the real world. And it is invariant because it's basically a ratio, right? It's a trigonometric ratio to get that angle. So they are invariant. So if I go 15 meters away from this ball and I try and cover up that ball, it should work exactly the same in real life. I should be able to have exactly that same angle to cover up the hugely big sun. That angle will be an invariant, both in the map and in real life. So none of you can get 15 meters away. What do you think 15 meters away would cover up this red ball? Try it, right? Does your thumb cover up that red ball? So first of all, let me comment about how we're going to measure things. We're always going to measure things with your hand as far away from your face as possible. See, lots of people not trying. They're afraid to hold their arm out, right? Could be some sort of antiperspirant commercial, I guess. So what I claim, none of you can get 15 meters away, but if after class, which is about to happen, if you went outside in the hall, I claim that not your whole pinky, but just the pinky nail held far out will just cover up this red ball. And I claim if you go out and carefully do that with the sun, you'll find that same fact, that the sun really is that small in the sky. Okay, so that's all they allow me to do on the first day.